world peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
The Economist. Hello and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Jason Palmer.
And I'm Ora Ogunbiyi. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
Japan's Noto Peninsula is still recovering from a massive earthquake on New Year's Day. It'll be recovering for years. Our correspondent pays a visit, finding how the country's preparedness has improved, but that geography will ultimately limit preparations.
And maybe you wear a corporate uniform at work. Maybe you wear the accepted uniform of your work species. I'm looking at you, tech bro. Both employer and employee could benefit from the official kind. Just maybe don't give it to the newbies. But first,
hi, Jean. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you, Georgia?
I'm really well. Do you mind just starting by telling us a little bit about yourself and telling our listeners?
I'm Jean Evely. I have a genetic collagen deficiency. It's classed as life-limiting. It means that I suffer pain daily. My joints can dislocate at any point in any given day. And as I'm getting older, I'm becoming more and more disabled and losing more and more of my bodily functions.
That sounds incredibly difficult to live with.
At some point, the suffering will become too much for me, and that's why having the choice of an assisted dying option is so important to me.
What would it mean to you if that option were available, if you knew that it was available?
At the point when I would say, I cannot carry on anymore, I cannot continue, it would take away the uncertainty of how much longer have I got to carry on with this? So I would not have always have this fear of, oh my God, how am I going to manage? How am I going to get through this? How much more of this can I take?
Not everyone suffering in a similar way to Jean would want the option to choose to die, nor should they ever be forced into it. It's an incredibly personal decision. But Jean is passionate about being able to decide when and how she will end her life.
Georgia Banjo is a Britain correspondent for The Economist.
Assisted dying is still very much illegal in Britain, but that could soon change. Both the leaders of the major political parties appear to be softening on this issue, and that means that there could soon be time in Parliament to debate a change in the law. The effect of this would mean that people right now who are suffering unbearably with terminal illnesses could have new choices at the end of their lives.
But Georgia, it wasn't too long ago that the government defeated a similar bill about assisted dying, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, that's right. So in 2015, there were two separate votes on this issue. There was one in Westminster and another one in Holyrood in Scotland. And the outcomes of both of those votes were the same. Both bills to support assisted dying were defeated, quite heavily actually. But since then, we've seen some really big shifts, I think. So we've seen internationally, it's now becoming a lot more common for countries to have assisted dying laws. We've also seen that medical opinion on this issue is shifting as well. So the BMA, which is the biggest doctors' union in Britain, has recently changed its position from one of opposition to neutrality. And I think that helps convince politicians that this might not be the fringe case it used to be. I think the other factor in this is that the public have always been very supportive of assisted dying. So the latest figures we have is, I think 70% of people support the right for someone who is terminally ill to get assistance to help them die.
So is it safe to say that a lot of the resistance to assisted dying is beginning to go away?
I don't think we can quite say that, mainly because people who oppose assisted dying often really oppose it. So sometimes that's for religious or ethical reasons. There are clearly many people who believe that life is sacred. And then there's also some really understandable concerns about the risks to vulnerable people. So people talk a lot about the risk of coercion, that a relative, perhaps greedy for an inheritance, might, in a horrible way, bump off granny or push someone into ending their life early. And then there are also concerns which I think are really understandable, that if you start to feel like a burden on your family, on your loved ones, or even your state or your country, that you might feel that that's the right or noble thing to do. Assisted dying laws attempt to safeguard against this. So a Scottish bill was recently introduced last month, and that has a cooling off period for 14 days for someone to reflect on their decision. If they're terminally ill with less than 6 months to live, it would suggest that they have to be independently checked by two doctors, that they have to be of sound mind. It has to be really clear it's their choice. But I spoke with a palliative care doctor who was very much opposed to the idea of introducing this. And he told me that you've got a longer warranty for your fridge freezer. So he doesn't think that would be much use.
You say that some other countries have already passed assisted dying laws. So have these concerns that are being raised, have they come to pass in those cases?
So again, it depends who you ask, because either side can always spin this accordingly by cherry picking facts. But what we do know is that one of the longest running jurisdictions to have assisted dying laws is Oregon, which introduced this in 1997. That's over 25 years, and we've never had a proven case of coercion. We've never had any disability group saying there's been a complaint. We've never had any suggestion that people have felt pressured into it. What we actually do know is that of all the people who receive the medication, only 2/3 of them ever actually take it. So a lot of people are getting this for peace of mind, and they're doing it because they want to have that choice at the end of their lives. We also know that far from it being the case that people are being killed too quickly, often the problem is that people are dying before they can even get the medication. So for this reason, in California, a cooling off period was reduced from 15 days to 2. But there are still concerns that poor healthcare, that a lack of palliative care options could make these sorts of deaths more appealing. Again, that's so far hard to prove. In fact, we've seen the opposite. In places like Australia, which have recently introduced assisted dying laws, palliative care funding has increased. And it's also worth pointing out that in Britain, if you would like to have an assisted death, the only option really for you is to go to Switzerland, which costs on average at least £15,000. So again, that's happening already, and it's happening for people who can afford it.
Georgia, it sounds to me like the safeguards in place are actually working quite well then.
Yeah, I think so. The question then is if they are working too well. So if you accept the principle that some people who are suffering unbearably should have the right to die, as most people do, the question then is whether the law goes far enough. So a good example of this is Sir Keir Starmer, who's the leader of the Labour Party here in Britain. And he used to be the director of public prosecutions. And at the time, he was really moved by the case of a young man called Daniel James. And Daniel James had a terrible rugby accident. He ended up becoming quadriplegic. And he decided that he wanted to die. His parents accompanied him to Switzerland. And it was there that he ended his life. Now, under proposed bills in Scotland and a likely bill were it to come into force in England, Daniel James would not have been eligible for an assisted death because his condition wasn't terminal. He's also quadriplegic, and the law stipulates, usually, that you have to administer the medication yourself. So I think the issue here is, were a law to be introduced, would it go far enough for these people? So Jean, who we heard from earlier, lives her life in incredible pain and worries a lot about her future. And she worries that people like her who are suffering unbearably might not qualify for a future law.
If the law only changes to allow people who are terminal in assisted death, my condition is not terminal. Even if I lost the ability to breathe for myself, I could live 40, 50, 60 years with a tracheostomy. So my option then would be to refuse treatment and have the machine turned off and have to suffocate.
And this is really, really difficult because while she supports the principle of assisted dying and would back any bill that includes it, someone like her would not qualify. And not only that, she wouldn't be able to go to Switzerland because she can't afford it.
So it all feels like a bit of a careful balancing act.
Yeah, exactly. I think everyone would agree that it's long overdue that we have another proper discussion about this issue. If a law were to be introduced, some people would understandably be worried about that. But for a lot of people like Jean, they'd probably be incredibly relieved.
Georgia, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Ori. Nice to speak with you.
World peace might feel kind of like a pipe dream, but what if I told you it's not? 2024 will see more than 50 elections around the world, and in some places, peace is actually on the ballot. One reason is because countries in Europe and Latin America have been experimenting with this thing called feminist foreign policy. Because right now, the way that we wage war and peace, it's kind of a boys' club. The new season of Things That Go Boom from Inkstick Media and PRX is coming March 18th. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm standing here in Suzu, on the northern tip of the Noto Peninsula, which juts off the northern coast of Honshu, the main island of Japan.
Noah Snyder is our Tokyo bureau chief.
It's a peaceful-seeming place, waves lapping against the shore, seagulls chirping in the distance. But on New Year's Day this year, a massive earthquake struck here, sending shockwaves rippling across the peninsula and tsunami waves heading for its shores. The disaster attracted attention from local and global media. It was headline news for days on end at the beginning of the year.
The Japanese government is stepping up the emergency response to Monday's earthquake, which
tsunami is tsunami warnings and 4-foot tsunami waves. This is the moment that the quake struck just a few hours ago. You see that
thousands
building
of people have spent the night in emergency shelters in Japan after a powerful earthquake.
But then, as is often the case, the spotlight turned elsewhere. Yet the recovery process is going to take weeks, months, probably years. I came here to learn more about that, crisscrossing the peninsula with aid workers and volunteers who are helping to demolish and clean up destroyed houses, searching for valuable and sentimental belongings amongst the rubble. We've chatted with residents who are still living in shelters because they have no homes to return to. We've seen the awesome damage that an earthquake can do.
So, Noah, talk us through how this earthquake actually played out.
On New Year's Day in Japan, the ground began shaking at around 4 p.m. As you might expect, lots of folks were at home with family or gathered together with loved ones. And what happened was the strongest earthquake to hit the country since the Great East Japan earthquake of 2011, which of course triggered a massive tsunami and precipitated the nuclear meltdown at Fukushima. This quake in Noto was a 7.6 magnitude. It triggered a process that seismologists call liquefaction. Basically, it's where normally solid ground turns into a liquid-like substance. Roads get warped, structures get twisted. Everything becomes unstable. And in parts of the peninsula, that of course meant that fires broke out, for example, in Wajima, the main city on the peninsula, where an entire central market district just burned to the ground, leaving a kind of charred wasteland behind.
And so more broadly, what was the damage like throughout the affected region?
really widespread. And one metric of that is the number of buildings that were damaged or destroyed, which is nearly 100,000. So newer structures survived, but a lot of traditional wooden houses, of which there are many in the Noto Peninsula, were just flattened. My colleague Moeka Ida and I spoke to Kamikawa Tetsuya of VNet, which is one of many nonprofits that are working on disaster recovery in the area. And he told us about some of the damage that they've been working through.
You probably cannot tell, but there was a road running and it was two houses, but they all collapsed because of the landslide.
So nearly 10,000 people are still displaced. Everyone we met was trying their best to maintain their dignity, to maintain a sense of pride and humanity, even amidst these really difficult circumstances. There was one scene at an evacuation center in Wajima that really seared into my memory. You enter and they had set up a traditional flower arrangement in the entryway, cherry blossom branch, narcissus, and a rape blossom flower. And they were serving green tea and little sweets on traditional lacquered trays, as you might get when entering a nice Japanese restaurant. And on the floor above them, folks were still sleeping in mats on the ground and dozens to a room. So it was really this sense of trying to hold it together as everything around them still feels like it's shaking. But despite all of this, I do think the damage could have been much worse.
And I remember we spoke to you last year about earthquakes and earthquake preparedness in Japan. Is it the fact that people have been thinking differently about how to prepare that things could have been worse?
I think that's definitely part of the answer, Jason. And yes, of course, Japan has a long history of earthquakes and of disasters of many stripes. And so there is a preparedness that runs through the society here. And that certainly helped in this case. Another reason why things turned out better than they might have simply has to do with luck. So the quake struck a peninsula that is relatively sparsely populated, relatively remote, and thus makes up a pretty small share of the country's population and of its GDP. And so economically speaking, the damage is manageable. It's something the government feels they can handle. The estimates is that it's going to cost about 2.6 trillion yen worth of damage. So that's about $17 billion, which is about half the amount of damage, for example, that another big quake in 2016 did in Kumamoto, a mid-sized city in southern Japan. And on top of that, there were fears in the initial minutes and hours after the quake that a really big tsunami would hit Noto. But mercifully, the waves turned out to be smaller than expected. So as Noto cleans up and tries to recover, Japan is trying to draw lessons for future disasters, as it does, to reinforce these systems for whenever the next earthquake inevitably strikes.
So what lessons will be drawn, do you think?
I think there are a few big ones. One has to do with the tyranny of geography, if you will. The Noto Peninsula is quite remote, and getting access, getting supplies in after the quake proved to be really difficult, more difficult than planners had imagined. The next has to do with the aging of the population and of the infrastructure. Noto is even more aged than the rest of Japan as a whole, and that means its population is especially vulnerable in disaster situations, and its infrastructure is too. So water, for example, has been a big problem in the wake of the earthquake. They've really struggled, and still many houses, many buildings are without running water. But there are some bright spots. There are Japanese startups that are providing decentralized water services, drones to ferry supplies in. So I think they're learning some lessons about how to deploy new technology to deal with some of these aging-related issues.
And what about the near-term future for Noto itself, the recovery efforts?
Well, just clearing away the debris from the earthquake is expected to take until 2026. The waste is something like 2.4 million tons, which is equivalent to essentially 7 years of the prefecture's garbage. I think the real long-term risk that worries many volunteers and disaster relief officials we spoke to is a kind of accelerated population decline, that people who were driven out of their homes during the quake won't ultimately come back. So I think it points to how disasters continue even after the immediate shaking stops.
Thanks very much for your time, Noah.
Thank you for having me, Jason.
work in an office and make your way there this week, it is pretty unlikely that anyone will be able to guess exactly what you do from your clothes. Take our London office, for example.
Corbin, can we bug you for 2 seconds, please?
Sorry, yeah.
Sorry to disturb your lunch.
No, that's okay.
Please, may you tell us about your outfit?
Well, normally I wear very serious shoes, like dark boots, but today I'm wearing white shoes. Also, this is the jumper that I pulled on because I didn't want to iron my shirt.
I also couldn't be bothered to iron my shirt, fair enough.
I'm wearing jeans, which are flares. And I did think about it, but then I did also think that half the reason you become a journalist is that you don't have to worry about bourgeois things like clothes.
Do you think journalists have, like, work attire that sets us apart as journalists?
I do think we have a bit of a uniform. We don't want to look too corporate, but then sometimes we have to meet fancy people, so we need to be smart enough. But we're not as self-consciously scruffy as tech people, I think, who really pay a lot of attention to their sneakers and would never wear a collared shirt.
What are you wearing today, Carrion?
I'm wearing a jumper and I'm wearing jeans. I sit in front of the mirror every day and I'm like, look, I work with a bunch of men who will wear the same thing every day. They're not wasting 10 minutes thinking about this. Am I wasting 10 minutes thinking about this? So then I just put jumper and jeans on. That's how it works.
Most of these outfit choices are probably best described as smart casual. Although, as you can tell, my colleagues have many interpretations of this. But sometimes an outfit can tell you exactly what someone does. Take the bus driver who gets you to your destination, the barista who makes your coffee, and the people on reception who wish you good morning. A poll of American workers conducted last summer by Gallup found that almost a quarter of employees wear uniforms to work.
So there are several reasons why employers might ask their staff to wear uniforms.
Andrew Palmer is The Economist's Britain editor and writes the Bartleby column about the workplace.
One is they don't have to worry about people turning up looking scruffy. Another is that it can project brand identity. So perhaps the most famous example of this is the Browns uniform of UPS delivery drivers. Sometimes uniforms have features which are just useful for the job. So chef's jackets, the white hat, the big double-breasted jacket with the buttons, that's very thick, so that helps to protect against heat and also splashes with burning liquids. And then there's also the benefit of signalling who should you go to if you've got a question. So there's none of that awkward, do you work here, as you're just waylaying some other shopper. When customers see people in uniform, they draw different conclusions than if they're not. And those conclusions can be for good, but they can also be for ill. So a study looked into how people respond if people are in uniform or not. So what they did was they asked participants in this experiment to imagine being on the receiving end of bad experience when they're picking up a pizza. They then showed the participants a number of staff members at this pizza company, some in uniform, some not, and they circled the ones which were responsible for this notionally bad experience. And participants were much more likely to blame the company for bad experience when the worker was in uniform. If the worker was not in uniform, they were more likely to blame the individual or circumstances. So there seems to be this spillover effect. If you're in uniform, you are more representative of the company. That's great if the service is good. It's less good if the service is bad. So the researchers suggest that one thing you might want to do is wait until an inexperienced worker is trained up before you put them in a uniform. Uniforms also affect the way that employees think and feel. So there's a term called enclosed cognition, and it's basically the idea that when you put on a certain uniform, it does affect your psychology. And to give you one example, a study gave participants the option to administer electric shocks to other people in return for money, and those who were dressed up in Red Cross uniforms showed more empathy than those who were wearing normal clothing. The
The effects that uniforms have on workers are obviously going to vary. So a uniform that confers a sense of professional identity, like a doctor's white coat, is likely to be more motivating than one that doesn't. People are going to be happier to wear a corporate uniform if they feel pride in their employer. Some uniforms are comfortable and some are not, and women usually get the worst of this. So it was only last year that female police officers in Britain were issued with body armour made to suit them. So one obvious objection to uniform is that they suppress individuality and autonomy. And certainly from the perspective of a journalist, it would seem odd, I think, to be constrained and to wear a particular uniform. But the fact is that even if you don't have to wear one on paper, people often gravitate towards a kind of uniform, probably for the reasons that we've discussed, professionalism, sense of belonging, etc. So there's a combination of shirt, trousers, and Patagonia gilet, which is known as the Midtown uniform for finance types in New York. And you can even see celebrity bosses making a brand out of a kind of uniform. It tends to be T-shirts for the Silicon Valley types. My own uniform tends to be a little Midtown, actually, as I look at myself. The main thing I'm trying to do is not have things inside out. So we may not all be required to put a uniform on when we head off to work, but you may nonetheless be wearing one.
This is Robert, our deputy editor. Robert, what are you wearing today?
You want me to look and see?
No, tell me.
Okay, I'm wearing a...
Do you think, you know, our vibes around workwear have changed a little bit? I mean, you're wearing Vajas.
Is this actually going somewhere? Oh, God. Okay, you need to take out that...
Why are you recording this? Is this intelligence on
we're
the run?
Yes.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi. This is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.